Hey listeners, before I get into this episode, I have a quick ask to make. I started this podcast as a research project on how to be a top individual contributor in the product design space. My goal for the show was to learn what it takes to be an individual contributor that is doing amazing, impactful work that they love doing day in and day out and getting paid top dollar while they do it. Becoming that type of individual contributor is the ultimate job security. With close to 100 hours of interview recordings, this has naturally led to the creation of the short-form video articles that synthesize my learnings into 10-minute listens of actionable content. You might recognize these as my morning walk episodes or the hashtag shorts episodes. To my surprise, those episodes have been very well received and listeners have enjoyed the synthesis of what I've learned. This has led to the next chapter of my research project, which is beginning to synthesize what I've learned into a new newsletter called Thinking Out Loud About Design that you can subscribe to right now for free. Thinking Out Loud About Design is an email newsletter and podcast that basically contains all my synthesis for my long-form interviews. It's pure distilled learnings that you can apply to your career immediately. This content is for you if you are a couple years into your career and you're trying to make that move from mid-level to senior designer and senior designer to staff designer. I mainly focus on becoming high-performing individual contributors in the product design industry. A free subscription gives you full access to the newsletter, podcast episodes, and website. You won't have to worry about missing anything because every new edition of the newsletter goes directly into your inbox. So my ask is this. If you have gotten any value out of the way of product design, or if it's helped you in any way or someone you know, please subscribe to Thinking Out Loud About Design and get the distilled learnings on being a staff-level individual contributor. You can find a link to the newsletter in the show notes of every episode of this podcast and on my LinkedIn page. Just look up Caden Damiano. Thanks again for listening and supporting the way of product design. I wouldn't be doing this if you guys weren't listening. Now, on to the show. Welcome to the Way of Product Design. I'm Caden Damiano. Hey, listener. So I found this this designer on LinkedIn, and he wrote a really insightful article that I like so much that I posted it. I reshared it on my page, and it just blew up. I don't know what it did, but it like hit the LinkedIn algorithm just the right way, and it just a few days it was like over close to 150 people interacted with it because whatever he wrote really resonated with everybody. So I'd like to introduce Tate Wayland. I couldn't resist, and I invite him to come on the show because. You obviously struck a chord with everybody. Tate, could you just introduce yourself to the listener a little bit and just let them know like your story, how you got to where you are today, and we'll go from there.
Sure. Thanks, Ben. So I've been a product designer mostly at startups for like 5 years now, with grad school in between there. So I work right now at a company called Adverse. It's like expense reporting tool. And, I'm sort of the designer on the growth division of that company. And prior to that, I've worked in everything from like online ticketing to ad tech. I think the thing that I kind of all those roles have in common is probably that I'm like usually the sole designer there and trying to like, improve design practices, do more user research, things like that.
Yeah, cool. So you're based in Brooklyn. And is that correct? You're in Brooklyn?
Yeah. I'm in Williamsburg, yeah.
Are you from New York, or like are you a local that just stayed there, or did you move there?
No, I moved here. I'm originally from Birmingham, Alabama. Oh, cool. I went to grad school in Pittsburgh, moved to San Francisco for a second, and then I got a job here as a short story and like ended up moving here. And for what it's worth, yeah, I think I'm kind of East Coast at heart.
Yeah, there's a big tech scene in Birmingham. Well, I think not the type of companies you're probably used to working for out of school, but has COVID made you reconsider New York, or
You gonna stay here when things return to normal?
You know, it's like, I think it's more of a consideration for my partner than me. Like, he's kind of ready to call quits on the city. I don't know. I'm torn. I mean, I think I'm. It's about time. It's definitely not worth rent right now.
Right. Well, Tate, I'm super glad to have you on the show. I'm just curious to hear, like, because a lot of people move to, like, New York and stuff, and because that's, like, oh, that's, like, where you have to go to, like, work at, like, you know, where all the design jobs are, like, for San Francisco and stuff like that. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just curious to hear, like, how people have, like, rethought of, like, oh, well, now more and more companies are going remote. I could get my job done anywhere. I've met a few people that are like leaving San Francisco and New York for like quieter places, you know? So I just always interested to ask that question because it is a very, it is a time in history where we're having a lot of existential thought about where we work and stuff like that. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, yeah. I mean, I guess we've probably thought about it a good bit. And, you know, I keep seeing these stats. It seems like most people want, like, 1 to 2 days a week in the office. Like, anybody that's been moved remote by COVID, it seems like the majority of people that answer those polls, like, most people want to come back, like, 1 to 2 days. But, yeah, I mean, I don't see the need for, like, you know, if you're building a startup right now, like, building a, you know, like, having an office in San Francisco or New York. It's probably not necessary anymore.
Yeah, and you know, not even for like tech. Like, I just my aunt-in-law, she just recently started a law firm, and she was going to get an office and everything, and then she just decided, like, hey, wait, this is working. Just doing the whole like remote thing, and she's going to have just a remote distributed law firm because she does immigration law and that can be done anywhere. And I don't know, it's just a really cool time, but I promise this will tie into the topic of the episode. I wanted to talk about talent today with you. The article you wrote is called, and off the top of my head, correct me if I'm wrong, it's Stop Evaluating Designers as Visual Designers or UX Designers as Visual Designers. Is that correct?
Yeah, product designers as visual designers, but yeah.
And you know, with like COVID and everything, a lot of the evaluation of talent is remote now, right? And can you just tell me a little bit about why you wrote that article? You must have been you must have got triggered or something to write it. Like, what was like your thesis of that article, and like what made you write a very well articulated rant on how talent's evaluated right now in the industry?
I guess there's a trigger, sure, but like I've written a few things before in the past, you know, all probably like triggered by something, but yeah, I mean, you know, you see like. After some amount of time, I guess I started keeping tally of like if I had a dime for every time somebody said like, oh, we're looking for someone with more like, especially visual design chops, like that one comes up incredibly often. And it's like, I don't know, there is a degree to how you can control that and like sort of fix that. If you're branding yourself as someone who can't do that, you can certainly like do things to improve that. But then it's like, when it comes to showing the work you've, you know, made, then it becomes an issue, I guess, because you want to kind of be honest to whatever you've built, and you don't want to just like make a dribble pretty and, you know, present the wrong thing.
Yeah, you talked about like how many times, like if you had like a nickel or a dime for every time that someone's like, oh yeah, like your portfolio is really good, like, you know, you're definitely like a really good designer, but we just need someone with some visual chops. Does that show just kind of like an inherent laziness, or is that like do you think that like hiring managers have time to even, like, you know, read, like, case studies? Is there, like, a better way to actually talk about process? Because I've had experiences like that as well. Like, oh, like, yeah, like, we need someone to just kind of, like, help out, you know, and just kind of, like, you know, help with, like, illustrations and the marketing site. No, like, your work's really good. And, you know, like, maybe, like, when we're bigger, we could worry about, like, architecture and interaction design and stuff like that. But I do feel like that is, like, a problem in the industry, that the people that have the better visual chops, like, get hired more. Like, what, like, why do you, like, think that is?
Well, I guess you bring up a couple examples. Like, one of them is definitely, like, not necessarily knowing what you're looking for, which is totally fine. I mean, that one's easy to sort of move on from. But the other, you know, is just, yeah, I mean, I think we all have an unconscious bias towards pretty things. And that is part of the job, certainly, is to, like, make things presentable. And, yeah, I think designers who work on pretty things or just make things, you know, have a excellent portfolio, like, they do stand out. And, you know, if you're looking at a lot of portfolios every day, yeah, visual designers are the ones that are probably going to get the most attention. It's just, especially if you're hiring from, like, a company that already has, like, beautiful visual design, it's just, like, if you see a designer that doesn't have it, then it's just, like, quick to write off. You know, it's easy to say, like, oh, they just don't fit the mold, you know? So I think that's probably part of the problem.
Yeah, and it's not like you are, you know, you look at your background, like, it's not like you are unqualified for the job. You got your master's at Carnegie Mellon, right, in interaction design?
Yeah, I did. So... yeah, I guess it's not a qualification. It's just, like, how do you present the other aspects of the job succinctly is definitely a challenge.
Yeah, so, I mean, you went to Carnegie Mellon. Like, that, I mean, I know I you're not the first graduate I've run into in the design world that has come from that place. Like, the process is, like, super rigorous. When I look at the portfolios of people that come from that, like, grad program, like, your decision-making is really on point for, like, really planning and designing, like, systems and, like, software and planning out interactions. Like, everything's so intentional. Like, I just, you know, fail. I fail to recognize, like, why that isn't perceived as more valuable. And I think you said it, like, it's more about, like, communicating, like, your value and stuff. Like, I mean, communicating, like, your process in a more consumable way than, like, oh, here's, like, this huge flow chart or this big, you know, heuristic evaluation document I did. Like, you have to read it and you have to consume it. Like, we have to be able to, like, distill that into, like, actionable insights. Like, I did this process, but here's, like, the actionable stuff I'm going to take from here. Like, have you, since you've, like, written that article, like, what have you, like, learned about presenting the more, like, interaction design work and stuff like that?
I guess I think of, like, insights from sort of, like, a marketing perspective. If I'm thinking of, like, good ad campaigns that, like, really convince me to maybe, like, buy a product, like a lot of it is it's about marketing. It's about, like, delivering a message, like, succinctly to the right audience. The audience in this case being, you know, a hiring manager. But like, something that comes to mind, for instance, is, like, I think it might have been, like, an old AirPods commercial or something where it was, like, ears are strange and they keep showing, like, all these different ears, and you're like, you know, see all these ears and you're like, those are all different ears, how could you fit a headphone into that? And then they kind of, like, you know, show you the punchline as, like, how they designed it, and it's like, okay, but, like, that's actually a lot of research and, like, a lot of, like, research informed design for that matter packed into, like, you know, 15 seconds. So
Yeah. Like, it's like establishing like the problem, telling a story about like the nuance of the problem, and then like what you did to address it in a very short manner. Like, yeah, so we did some work on it and then we came out with this. Yeah, like, I mean, speaking of like Apple commercials, they always like present their products like, oh yeah, that's obvious. Like I feel like if you do your work well as an interaction designer, because that's what I studied in school as well. So like I had to deep dive, learn on my own, like the graphic design principles that I needed to be competitive in this market. And if you do your interaction design job well, then you should be able to speak of like an outcome of each design decision. So instead of talking about like, oh, like, well, we did this journey mapping exercise and stuff like that, you like, that's for you. Like, the journey map's not a deliverable. Like, the journey map's the process. It like helps you understand the problem more, and then you should be able to distill that into a actionable sentence. Like, okay, so we laid it out, the screen out like this, so that we could keep these elements closer together to allow for a quicker workflow. By doing that, we've reduced time to task by like 30 seconds or something like that. I think that is better than talking about your process as a designer. I think the big insight for me, and I wonder if this is the same for you, is that all the stuff you learn in school, all the rigorous process and the frameworks that help you make better design decisions and wrap your head around complexity, is like only for you. Like, hiring managers don't care about that stuff. Like, they see process like artifacts all the time. They care about like, okay, then what? What did you do? And that's really all they care about.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Like, how did you use those insights? And also, you know, whatever you shift, how do you measure success is like definitely a big part of the processes.
Yeah, so, you know, I know that another thing in your article that you talked about is that the way that software design is going, I don't see why hiring managers are hiring more visual designers, especially when they have a design system that like automates a lot of those visual decisions. Like, there's like a diminishing return to that. Is that like what you're seeing more and more in like, at least like the Brooklyn market, that like more and more companies are having design systems and stuff like that? Like, that there's less of a need to stack your team with that, those kind of designers?
Yeah. I mean, like you said, like a lot of the sort of remote now, but any place I've looked generally have good, visual design vocabulary. And, you know, before I go, like, get like too far into this, it's like, first of all, like visual designers are great. You know, the ones that I know, at least, the ones I work with, they tend to collaborate with quite a lot of people in order to sort of like build a design system in order to make that like scale. So yeah, anything I'm building generally in terms of features kind of rests on their work. And yeah, that's sort of the point, is that that kind of applies anywhere, though. It's like, at most, I'm sort of inheriting a design system and maybe like suggesting ways to expand on that system, like build out a feature. But for the most part, yeah, I'm not really sweating like padding, like buttons or anything like that.
Well, yeah, like that's kind of like the direction of the industry right now. Like, from my perspective, is that the small stuff's going to get sweated out by like a centralized team, like a design system team. In the future, that's like going to be more and more best practice in like digital product design. And then you can worry more about the interaction design and stuff like that. It's just, there is like an issue of, we're still being evaluated by our UI chops. And they're like, yeah, like the job that I got hired for, like a couple, like me and another candidate, we're being evaluated like visual designers. Like, well, like, yeah, his process is really good, but like, I just don't see like strong visual chops. But the problem was, is that they had a design system. The other candidate ran into that same problem, but she was a little bit smarter than me, and she was more on top of it in the interview process, because she did get hired. So she was like, yeah, but don't you guys have a design system? And they're like, yeah. And she's like, why does that matter? Like, why? I'm not going to be designing like visuals for you. Like, I could lay out your button styles and your form components. I understand 8-pixel grid. I understand like hierarchy layout, which my work shows. Like, why does it matter that I can't make things? Like, I don't show a lot of work of me making things from scratch.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's the thing, is like, I'm not really showing things that are made from scratch. I'm kind of showing things that are inheriting a system. And like, the things I'm focused on that project are kind of like visuals almost, I don't want to say it's at the bottom, but it's definitely like, okay, I'm referencing other screens within our UI. I'm referencing the design system. Everything I'm building is like sort of consistent with patterns that are established everywhere else, but I'm thinking about states. I'm thinking about like what happens if, you know, there's an error here, like all these different scenarios. I'm, you know, testing those kind of things. I'm maybe even thinking about like at some point, like second level consequences of like shipping something. Like if you add this here, it might break another, you know, setting or something like that. Those are the kind of decisions that I think we actually kind of make on the day-to-day. Like, those are the details we focus on.
Well, yeah, and that's why, like, that's what we get paid the big bucks for. Like, there's a reason why we get paid more than, like, the average salary for designer, like, product designers, UX designers, is more than, like, a graphic designer, is because, really, like, what we're being paid for is to provide a competitive edge to the business. And we're paid to prevent downstream consequences from happening. Like, we have to, if we're not thinking about the worst case scenario or like the slightly bad scenario, and like, well, how will our system handle this, like, then you're having them pay for customer support calls and stuff like that. And if you don't have like a good user experience, it's like self-service and stuff like that. Then, yeah, they're paying humans to solve the problems you didn't solve. But, I mean, like, the worth of a product that could scale and be self-service because the UX is good is so valuable. But it's not worrying about, I mean, it's not usually worrying about, like, the visual aesthetic, like the padding and stuff like that. It's the utility of the product at that point.
Right, exactly. And that being said, I mean, I guess I've seen enough wireframes from like product managers to know that like visual like matters to some extent, just because it's like, yeah. And I guess that's part of the problem, is that like it does matter and people are going to see it. It's just that like it's not necessarily in your control if you've like shipped something that's like consistent with the rest of the product. So it's two things. It's like, two ways to combat that is like to maybe like service what you did do a little more succinctly, like all the other things you uncovered and like how you handle all these, like, you know, what goes wrong scenarios in the case study. And then also like, I guess another plan is like, maybe you could have, you know, just a case study that's like you redesigning parts of products you worked on.
Yeah, like, oh, well, here's like the fancy way I would do it. yeah
exactly, like I know this typesetting is whack, and like I know the screen isn't like visually beautiful, but like if I did it from scratch, like this is what I would do. Is one way to approach it, at least.
Yeah, and like, let me be clear with the listener, I'm not trying to do gotcha journalism on visual design. I think it's really important. I've spent a lot of money getting good at it. I understand the value of a design system. Actually, the design. So, I mean, you actually at the beginning of your article talk about how, like, your whole thesis is, hey, like, we should stop evaluating designers, like visual designers. But like later in the article, you talk about how the design system, how valuable the design system is in like making or breaking someone's career. Like, so if you work for Spotify and you have access to that glorious design system, your case studies are going to pop no matter what. And you technically didn't make the components there. Most designers that use Spotify's components didn't invent those components. They used them in their product and it made the UI look so crisp and clean. And that makes them look like they got good visual chops. Like, but if you're a company that has a really bad design system, you're actually less attracted to designers because you're like, oh, your product doesn't look good. This is going to hurt my career.
Right. Somebody even like pointed out that there is like a business ROI to visual design that I thought was interesting. I was like, I'm gonna bookmark this because like you're gonna escalate that to your company and be like, look, how about we like fix this? If we have a bad design system, let's like invest some money into fixing that, and it's gonna be worth more than like other features. Mm-hmm. But yeah, to your point, yeah, if I worked at like, you know, Spotify or something and built some of the same features, I think that's the real, like, that's the real pedigree, right? Like a master's degree is a master's degree, but like what you've worked on, if it looks pretty out of the box, then like that definitely gets you conversations.
Yeah, for sure. So tell me a little bit about that article that you learned about the ROI of visual design. Like, could you remember any like nuggets from it that?
I wish I could give like actual figures, but like I will say, like, yeah, like all I remember is the gist is there's a significant difference in like perception, like of the value of a product, based on whether it's like design, like the visual design is good or not. Like that does create like a first impression on people and does change how people like assess the value of things, was essentially what the white paper was.
Yeah, it's the aesthetic usability effect. If it like looks good and there's like a subtle motion design elements to it, it looks more legit and valuable. Mm-hmm. Like for me, like what I learned about the value of visual design when I was like learning how to do it, doing the Shift Nudge course by Matt Smith, I was. I was actually floored by how much UX improvements I can make by like subtle tweaks to the user interface. Like I could solve a lot of UX problems with when I had a stronger command of the interface design. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, have you ever noticed that people that don't have as strong of UI design chops? So let's not talk about visual, like poster design, graphic design. Let's talk about strong UI design chops, like good layout. They understand how to make a component for a design system. When people aren't good at that, they get very simplistic in their solutions. Someone that's really good at process and they're like great at articulating what the problem is. They're like, we know the problem is people are dropping off here. We know it's because of maybe this interaction model or something like that, but they might not be that good at UI design. And because of that, their solution's very simple. They're like, oh, well, all we need to do is just put a drop-down menu here, you know? Or,
oh, yeah.
are you getting what I'm saying a little bit more? Like, it's like the solution. This is kind of like, because like you don't have to be a UX designer to know what the UX problem is sometimes. Like PMs like could look at analytics and be like, hey, there's a problem here. But then they start going into solutioning and it gets very like simplistic. I would say that like really strong interaction designers with subpar UI design skills aren't as effective in creating a solution than someone that has strong UI design skills, but maybe has the benefit of like also having the same insight.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of reminds me of like, do you ever listen to this podcast, like What Is Wrong With UX? And I'll just credit them for this, but like they had a podcast about like user stories recently, and it kind of is a topic of like, you can have like user stories that are anything from, you know, conversions on this, you know, page are low, let's say, versus users need a dropdown to select, like additional option. You know, it's like, it can get like very, very specific, and it can be very like prescribed, or it can be very like open-ended and like left to the designer to sort of discover the heart of the problem and suggest solutions to it. And I think I'm kind of a fan of more of like the metrics approach, because it's, yeah, if you're saying like, oh, retention's bad or like conversions are low, it's up to me to like sort of say like, well, here's why, you know, like here's a few reasons why, maybe even, and like, here's a few ways to fix it.
Yeah. So what in that episode of like, what's wrong with the UX, it's, if you are getting that specific in the user story, like, oh, as a user, I want a drop down. It's like, well, where in the research said that they like wanted a drop down? Is there like a quote that told them that told us that they want that specific interaction? Does it have to be a drop down?
Right. It doesn't. I mean, I think that's the general, like, I mean, it's just sort of, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think we all have a habit of like, maybe like, I certainly probably am guilty of overreaching every now and then, and like stepping into like almost like a PM hat sometimes. And like, maybe like PMs kind of do the opposite every now and then, where they get like a little too specific. And you know, it kind of depends on your structure and like what, depends on your culture and how do ideas even surface and get built in the first place. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, generally, if I get something that's a little too prescribed, I do ask a lot of questions, you know, like why do we need that? And, you know, like, how do we know that this is going to like provide, you know, whatever revenue or whatever success metric we think it will?
Yeah, because, and imagine, like, I mean, you if you're a good designer, you kind of question like, oh, that's really specific, a drop-down menu. Like, yeah, why is that? Like, what did the research say that like a drop-down would be good? Because if you have that like inquisitiveness to just really like understand the problem, you're just curious. Like, you're not criticizing the PM or maybe like a designer you paired with on the project that might not have a strong of like UI design skills, and then you pair that with like really strong UI design skills. Then you could be like, oh, mm-hmm. Well, maybe it isn't a drop down. Maybe it's a tile card layout, because it's really only like a couple options. And
yeah,
maybe it'd be like easier for them if you just like laid out the options in front of them like this. And then, I mean, dare I say, we get into illustration territory. It's like, oh, and maybe we could talk about illustrations and stuff here and stuff like that. But like, if you don't have that, like, that tact of understanding all the different UI patterns and like being able to execute and actually push the pixels down to like that level of proficiency, mm-hmm. then it's almost like you have a lot of good ideas, but there's this untapped potential, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, wait, can you repeat that, the last sentence? I was just trying to, like...
Yeah, no problem.
I was holding on to something, yeah.
What I'm saying is that good product designers, modern-day product designers, should have a solid handle on strong UI design. And that's a total 180 from what I've said when I started my career. Because I'd get mad, too, when people are like, oh, you don't have visual chops. Like, you're not showing enough visual chops in your work or something. And so I'm going to give this job to someone else that might not be as good of an interaction designer, but when it comes down to it, they could execute on the pixel pushing and they could actually like make good design system components and stuff. Right. Mm-hmm. Like the having a strong hold on the craft of being able to make things from scratch makes you a better UX designer. That's like my thesis.
Yeah, that's true. Like, if you are able, if you have the freedom to build things from the ground up, then yeah, I mean, I think, is that what you're saying? Like, that's...
Yeah, Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think the problem is that people are always going to evaluate us like visual designers. I think they're always going to evaluate craft first. Hiring managers are always going to do that. So, like, facing that reality is just kind of a necessity to survive, right? To be competitive. Like, hey, like, this is what they're looking at first, and then they'll, if they like your visuals, then they'll read your case studies because you kind of hooked them in already. And then they'll be like, oh, they're also really good at, like, systems thinking and interaction design and information architecture as well, right? But, like, you have to show in your portfolio that you have those kind of, like, visual chops as well.
Right, exactly. I think you do. There's some ways to do that. But, I mean, I think if I could, like, prescribe anything or suggest anything, I do think, like, there's not enough attention for, like, designers who can take a system and apply it, you know, consistently. It's like, if you find, like, because it's actually kind of hard to discover if you're looking at a designer's portfolio, because you'd also have to kind of, like, know their product and, like, know what they're working on.
Yeah.
To even see if it kind of, like, lines, like, is it in rhythm is how I would kind of describe it. Like, is it on the same beat as, like, everything else that's been built? Because that's actually going to add more value than a designer who, like, comes and they design something completely inconsistent with everything else, and I have to tell them to, like, go back and, like, do it consistently. Like, that's definitely bad. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, you actually made an example in your article where you're like, here's this really dope design. Like, I saw this problem and I made it. And I made sure that it was, like, readable and that the colors were better. And then I showed it to my developers, and they're like, this does not look like the rest of our product.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. Like, at the end of the day, you have, you know, resource constraints, and you can't just build the whole design language from the ground up. At any, as a matter of fact, I mean, it's a kind of, like, That's why, like, people who work on design systems have a tough job, for that matter, is because, like, the implications of, like, changing the buttons, the type, style, if you show that on every single page, you're going to break a few pages, and now you have to, like, rethink those pages. So it's like, I can't just, like, introduce a new visual design language without, like, really thinking of everywhere it's going to be applied.
Yeah, it's like, man... Like, a good design system's just table stakes, because I would never want to be on a design system team. Like, that just does not draw me at all. But, yeah. Like, I wouldn't work at a company that doesn't have, like, dedicated design system developers at a minimum, right? Like, people that, like, manage those components from a code perspective. Like, because the idea of, like, if they're not thinking systematically about consistency of visual style, like, component consistency and stuff, like, I'm going to have a really hard time making scalable solutions.
Right. Yeah. It even goes, like, above that. It's also just, like, consistency and, like, application. Like, use this for, like a card could be in, like, a couple different states. I sort of, like, document those kind of things, like, why one works for another. Like, that's, I actually kind of love the idea of, like, working on a design system, but I don't, like, I don't know where I would fit, because it's really more about, like, what to say, like, okay, I like this button, but let me go, like, put it on 100 pages, or I like this, like, component, but, like, let me show you where it breaks. Let me find the place that doesn't work, so we have to, like, classify or, like, add another state or something. Yeah.
Yeah, you'd like to support them, but you don't want to, like, you're not sure, like, where you'd fit in the actual team, where you're just thinking about components every day and, like, where they fit and stuff. And, you know, the team I work on, we had dedicated design system designers, and basically, like, that was my one of the jobs. If I was being helpful to the design system team, I would point out, like, hey, this component isn't working, I need a new component. Yeah. And just providing feedback to them and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of, like, my interactions on the day-to-day. In fact, like, our science system is so sort of new and evolving right now, like I said. So I was working on, I'm working on this like analytics product and having to introduce like as it, like whole new things. But I mean, like the only thing I'm really inheriting here are like colors, type, sizes, things like that. But like how this list view works and like whether or not like a, you know, you click on something in the list and it's like active, like I introduced those things and then it's sort of like talk to the designer there and it's like, okay, we have to agree that like anything in an active state has like this shade of blue basically that like is in the design system, but had we hadn't really decided like what an active, you know, list item looks like yet. Like things like that, for example, that like, yeah, as you're working on things, you end up introducing things and kind of circling back with that team all the time, especially at the beginning. But eventually, yeah, you have like some best practices, you have a rhythm, and you're really just thinking about all the other things, basically.
Yeah, like, man, like this job's hard because like you have to manage like making and building the right thing, but you know that you're getting shot in the foot if you don't have like the UI component standardized. Like you're almost like set up to fail. Like it doesn't matter how like good your process is or anything like that. Like you're always not going to reach, like the product's not going to reach its full potential if like those things aren't standardized at like a, mm-hmm. at a component level.
Right. It's just like, I mean, it's probably measurable. I mean, like I'm sure I've seen this at some point that like, yeah, if you have like consistency and like forms and the way you're presenting things to people, it does improve accessibility and, you know, improves the experience in marginal measurable ways versus like whenever you have like an inconsistency that there is like a probably significant difference. That being said, yeah, I would feel more comfortable having that white paper in front of me instead of like talking about it. But you led me to another thought, which was that you know, I had, like when you said like design's hard, it's like some, like I had this mentor that said like design is in the details, and well, that's true. It's like it was like really aggravating because it's like it is in the details, but it's like there's a lot of details, and it's your choice which ones to pay attention to. At the same time, like there's like, okay, you could like really stress the padding. You could stress a lot of things here and improve those, but then like, what are you blinded to? What are you not paying attention to? With the cost of that? Like I'm spending all day working on this like one piece and like not thinking about, you know, something extraneous that's like very related to it.
Yeah, you're almost talking about the design PM type work, or like the resource allocation. Like a big part of your job as the designer is to allocate resources towards a problem. Mm-hmm. And if you are, ooh, I'm glad you brought this up, because actually I've been thinking about this a lot lately. And the hypothesis is that designers who design purely based off design principles are going to focus on the wrong things. But if you define the problem first, then you leverage design principles against that problem. You design against that problem. You're gonna realize like, oh, okay, this is an interaction design problem, or oh, this is a visual inconsistency problem. Like it allows you to diagnose the specific part of the whole profession of design that you should be focusing in on. So, for example, like James Dyson was being interviewed about his vacuum and by like a design magazine, and they were like, oh yeah, like James, like why did you design it like this yellow and like the canister like this? Was this supposed to be like representative of like whatever like philosophical things happening when that interview was made, whatever time? And he's like, no, I'm doing it because that's how big it needs to be to create this like velocity in the canister, to like create enough suction to pick up dust. Like for him, it's like form, like form always follows function, right? And as products get more mature, you are starting to address like, okay, well, technically this thing's usable, like this legacy product, but it's not a good product. It's not delivering value to the user, because at the end of the day, if the experience breaks, they have to call customer service. Like, it doesn't matter how usable this flow is. It's mm-hmm. not like it's not treating unhappy paths.
Right. Exactly. I guess if you're saying like that in this analogy, like all the attention to like the user experience is equivalent to like Dyson's attention to like the suction.
Yeah. You're just, what's a vacuum solving? Like, it has to pick up dirt. Like, that's so right. All you're designing, using design principles and physics to solve against that problem. You're designing against that problem when,
right.
Like what's your product trying to solve? It's expense management, and you're probably working on analytics for bosses to like see how their employees are spending their money, right?
Finance people who work in finance and like different big companies that they want to see like how are people like spending money and like whether or not they're submitting expenses on time, basically. I wanted to draw attention to when you said like, yeah, vacuum's objective is to suck dirt. I make this kind of analogy all the time, and it's like, it kind of goes back to the user stories thing. It's almost like what is your objective? Like, what problem are you solving before you prescribe a solution to it? And like, yeah, exactly. Like, a vacuum sucks dirt. If you find a better way to do that without a vacuum, that's great.
Yeah, and that leaves it open for the designer to really come up with like the best solution, because there's a lot of different ways to add to 10, 5 plus 5 equals 10, 2 plus 8 equals 10. This is really testing my on-the-fly math, by the way. Actually, another guest I had, Denise Hurtado, was on the show, and she wrote in an article like, you know, you can't just critique the visual design, right? Like, because, you know, she uses that example of like, there's a lot of ways to get to 10. You could do 1 plus 1 plus mm-hmm. 1 plus 1, 10 times. And that's how you get to 10, but it's not very efficient, right? You know, you could do 5 times 2. That's more efficient, or like, 2 something cubed or whatever. Okay. Now I'm really pushing it, the analogy, but, like just prescribing in the user story, like the solution is kind of like the definition of a leading question. Like, okay, there's a problem mm-hmm. here. Do you think a drop down would be the best solution? That kind of closes off creativity.
Yeah. Exactly. I think, on that point, yeah, I think in fact, like a lot of the work, you know, especially in grad school, but like, since I think what I appreciate the most about UX is like sort of the psychology aspect of it, because it's really just about like how do people behave and perceive things, and there's some principles there you can follow, but at the end of the day, that does require, I mean, you could, you know, if design is in the details, you can pay attention to those details too. You know, you can pay attention to like, you know, testing that and kind of seeing like the perception of something many times over versus like sweating out like one visual design. I don't know where I was going with that, but it's kind of in the same vein.
Hey, well, I mean, if it makes you feel any better, I don't interview people because they're experts. I'm interviewing people because they have an opinion, and it's totally okay to think out loud on this show because we're pushing the conversation forward, right? Like, I mean, the big takeaway just talking to you is that visual design's only valuable if you're focusing on the right details. And how do you focus on the right details? You have to define the outcome, like the problem, you know, first, and define that well. And then, if you have that defined well and you're a good UI designer, oh man, like sky's the limit. Like, you can make some really cool stuff that solves the problem.
Right. I think it does kind of rest on like us to sort of show that we're a little more well-rounded maybe. I mean, like for instance, for me, like I actually everybody like probably has a different story for how they got into UX, but like I was an art major in undergrad, and like really I got into this because I was like I was leading a Code for America brigade in Birmingham, and just kind of seeing like this intersection between, like, that's kind of how I discovered UX, is like this intersection of like, okay, I'm making these like civic tech apps, but like really thinking of the consequences of like how to do that ethically and like considerate of the users, but also like, I mean, that to me, like, that was design. Like, that is like one case study. Like, Dana Chisnell, I think, is probably the expert on this, like, talks about like hanging chads in Florida and how like that was like consequential in 2000. Like, design can lead to bad consequences is kind of like the way. So I mixed that with like I got into my first field kind of doing like half front end development, half design at this first job, you know? And like, if anything, that kind of built up like, okay, I treat everything almost like Lego blocks a little bit. I'm a little bit more prone to see things as a design system whenever I'm like building wireframes. And yeah, you can come at it from different backgrounds and it's just kind of like show in different ways. But like, ultimately, I think the trap is that like, especially when you work on like something that like has bad visual design, like how do you communicate the work you did anyway in a way that like actually sells?
Yeah, like I think it's funny. I think, well, the debate's over on like, should designers code? 2020, it's a no. But I'm like, should interaction designers learn like visual design? I'm still debating that.
Like, oh, for sure. Yeah,
should designers learn every design discipline? We should talk about that first before we talk about should designers learn to code or learn business? Like, should they learn the whole breadth of what a designer could do?
Yeah, I feel like my answer to this a year ago would be like, honestly, they should learn enough code to be dangerous, at least. You should learn visual design, you should learn business. But then it's like, if you're learning all these things, you are spreading yourself out quite a lot. And in this industry, it's getting more and more specialized. So it's like being able to just stand out as like the person that does this job really well. Mm-hmm. I think that's maybe the issue is that that's easiest to do as a visual designer. Like you can stand out as a visual designer. Not that visual design is easy, but like you can stand out and make yourself seen very easily. If that's what you're working on and that's the kind of job you want. But if the job you want is, if you want to like make more design decisions, if you want to like do more research for that matter, like those kind of things are hard to express in case studies. But it's also like hard to find the jobs that want that, you know, basically the way they're written. Maybe they say they want that, but in reality, like they don't really want that role. They, you know, when it comes down to it.
Yeah. Like I always feel like you have to prove it when you go in, like like when I'm talking about like how I'm trying to solve a design problem by encouraging the engineers to engineer something more eloquently. They're like, well, you're a designer. Why do you care about this database stuff? And I'm like, because I'm a product designer, and how the product is engineered is going to influence the user experience. And I just have to be willing to have those conversations. And it's the ROI of that is fine. You know, it's like you gotta, I think it is strange for people when they're like, when the designer's like asking about business requirements and poking back at them and stuff. But like the more you understand the problem, like the better of a designer you're going to be. I think, yeah, you should code enough to be dangerous. But now I wish, like, if I could go back and prioritize learning something, I'd spend less time on Pluralsight learning how to code, and I'd be spending more time learning graphic design principles, because those I use more in my day-to-day than all the knowledge I learned from like learning a JavaScript, basics of JavaScript and stuff like that. And then I'd prioritize learning code after that.
Yeah, I guess it depends. I mean, like for me, I would actually say, if anything, like sometimes like turning my general soft skills like communication and business, like how do I express like your data systems, that's a good analogy for me. And I think for me, it's like that's where I stick myself probably in the product manager's role more often than people like, because I'm like, okay, so what data are we collecting, and like did people consent to that? What are the consequences if they find out? Like those are UX design, that's a product designer's concern. I mean, like, and like how do I adjust to a business impact of like, if people, if you collect this in the wrong way, you know, what happens if there's a breach? Like, what happens if this is, you know, like, can you do this more ethically and more conservatively? Because this could affect your bottom line. You know, it's like, how do I express that to a business or get allies? I guess it depends on the case.
For sure. Like, this could go anywhere. I could do this all night. I could do this all day. Most nighttime right now. But like Tate, again, thanks for coming on the show. I'm just gonna ask you one more question, and then we'll wrap up. What's a setback that happened in your career that you're glad happened?
Ooh. I feel like this one might be easier to answer in like 10 years than it is now.
Nothing bad happens to
Tim. Because, like, let's see. I mean, I think my capstone project in grad school was, like, a time to really shine, you know, and, like, have, like, an awesome project and then, like, land at, like, one of these great firms right after that. But then we kind of, like, screwed the pooch on that a little bit. But at the same time, I don't know. If anything, like, that's kept me humble, you know. I think if anything, I will look back on and say like, oh, because everywhere I've worked, it's like it's been a grind, and it's been, you know, at places where, you know, the justice has kept me humble, and like you kind of have to earn your share and like sort of like demonstrate value at every step, and then like work your way back up to those kind of like prestigious places, maybe, or for that matter, you might, you know, go in a different direction, like start leading somewhere. But yeah, I think if anything, yeah, it's probably like that capstone project. Cause like, yeah.
Yeah. It's well, I think I feel the same way too. Like working at lower, helping companies become more mature in their product and design practice, is a challenge, but it also like makes you more in touch with like what it takes to be a mature organization. And I, you look at the people like at Google and stuff like that, the people that built those design programs at these big prestigious firms, like Spotify was that immature company at the beginning. They still had to, they had to define their design ops. And I mean, like when you get to that point where you can lead Tate, right? Like I bet you're going to know what it takes to build a design team. And I think that, is a better hero's journey than just starting at the top of the mountain and not struggling, right? So
yeah exactly. I mean, I think that's definitely true. And it's also like how to handle when like, can I don't know if I can cuss on this podcast, when shit hits.
Yeah, go ahead.
Definitely run into people. Yeah, like if when shit hits the fan, like I know a lot of people who can't handle that, and I think I'm much better at just handling like chaos basically and just like working through it. Whereas, you know, yeah, I mean, it's just, I think it goes back to something I said a minute ago where it's like wherever you come from, your background, you know, it does ultimately like attribute to, you know, strengths later on too.
Yeah. Well, Tate, thanks for coming on the show. I would recommend that anyone reaches out to you on like LinkedIn, connects with you, reads your Medium posts and stuff like that. Is there anything else you want to talk? You want to say before we sign off?
It's great being on here. I have nothing really to add, but yeah, thanks, Caden.
You're a really humble, dude. You're just like, oh no. Like I don't know if I'm the right person to talk about this, but you've really provided some great insights. So thanks again for sharing them. And I'm sure someone that's listening to this right now is getting a lot of value out of it. So you have a good one.
Thanks, you too. Have a good day.
Hey listeners. Thanks again for listening to another episode of The Way of Product Design. If this episode resonated with you, please share it with your network and write a couple lines on why you found it useful. And if you haven't already, subscribe to the podcast. And if you want to help the show grow, please leave a review on Apple or Google's podcast platforms. As always, thanks for listening. You have a good one.